Hey, farmers and landowners, this is Damian Mason coming at you with a question. Have you ever had disease or pest problems cost you money by reducing your yield? Well, of course you have. We fight this, right? That's what production agriculture is all about, is working as best we can to put out a great yield. And to do so, oftentimes, you've got to overcome disease and pests. The problem is we usually treat those diseases and pests after the problem, right? So what if you could do it proactively? What if you had a tool that gave you predictive analytics so that you would know if you have things like corn rootworm, soybean cyst nematode, sudden death syndrome? Well, you have that tool now. It's from Pattern Ag. Pattern Ag, doing predictive soil analytics way beyond just the old days of sticking a probe in the ground every few acres and saying, hey, wow, we got some nitrogen deficiency here. They'll let you know if you have pests and disease. Go to pattern.ag. That's www.pattern.ag to learn more about this awesome technology and how it can help you increase your yields by taking care of diseases and pests before they cause you harm. Well, greetings and welcome to another fantastic episode of the Business of Agriculture podcast. It's me, your host, Damian Mason. You already knew that because you knew that when you tuned in. I've got a program today that you're going to really like. We're talking about income diversification. We're talking about new ventures to accentuate your bottom line. More importantly, we're talking about agricultural direct-to-consumer businesses. It's kind of a big growing area. How viable is it? How realistic is it? Well, I've got Kelly Garrett. He's one of my bosses, one of the founders of Extreme Ag. As you probably have heard, I work for Extreme Ag, recording their Cutting the Curve podcast, and I've been doing events for them for about a year and a half now. And Garrett Land and Cattle, Kelly Garrett's operation in Arion, Iowa, struck me as something we should be talking about. He is doing a direct-to-consumer beef business right now, in addition to his farming operation and his trucking business and his plant food business. So I'm like, hey, you're an entrepreneurial guy. I think that we are seeing a bigger opportunity now in the rural America to do something like this. And I said, let's come on here and talk about the business side of Garrett Land and Cattle direct-to-consumer beef. So anyway, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. I've been to the operation. I've been to the office. You talk about it being, fifth generation, 1880s, 1860s, I think maybe it was, when somebody named Garrett settled over there in northwest Iowa. So you've got a legacy, but you're good in that, what's the old thing? First generation makes it, second generation holds on to it, third generation pisses it away. Well, you're like fifth generation, and you're still building upon it. Tell me about that, the legacy and the drive for you to keep doing this.
You know, I just, I always want to get better all the time. And I have almost have a disease where I have a hard time stepping over what I see as an opportunity. Sometimes, you know, my dad or my wife will say, when is enough enough? And I just don't ever look at it that way. I want to continue to get better. If there's something that we can do and we can do it well, let's do it.
It's not just about the money, but it is about the money. You know, businesses exist to make money. And I'm sure that somebody down the road says, well, damn it, that guy, he's got all that farm ground, farm 7,000 and some odd acres. Why does he need to do this? It's also about something that you think you can do better. It's not just, you know, you went to the store, you were out here in Arizona last winter, and you were talking about pricing at the store. And I said, yeah, but remember, you're not going to be selling this stuff at a retail outlet in Paradise Valley, Arizona. You know, so there is the money and the business side of it. But there is the, I guess, what was the drive? Diversification, new income streams, proving that you could, creating a better product. What was the purpose? What was the driving force?
It is all of those things. But obviously, we conduct business or we take on a new venture because we want to make money.
Yep.
But that isn't all of it. The direct to the consumer, our cattle operation is something that we're all very passionate about. And so I am proud of the cattle that we raise. I'm proud of the product that we now have in our new store. And I feel like if we go and we do a good job of this, that the money will take care of itself. It doesn't, you know, we have to pay attention to the financials, obviously, but I don't live and die off every penny every day. I just try to go out and do a good job, knowing that hopefully there's enough margin built in that it'll be all right. It's not profitable yet. We just opened on Labor Day, but I'm very optimistic about it.
All right. So you've got this thing where you're more entrepreneurial than some. And I kind of have this too. I always say boil it down to one of your driving forces. Our friend Will asked me why I got into what I did 29 years ago when I quit my job. And I said two reasons. I wanted to be more creative and I wanted to be more in charge of my own compensation. So I look at what you're doing here and I see an outlet for creativity and compensation. You're saying, well, what's so creative about selling cattle? Well, you created a store. You create an online presence. There's a creativity to this. And then there's the compensation. Which one's more exciting to you? Seeing something come from inception to completion, or to at least evolution, or the money? Which one gets you more excited?
The evolution, the building it. You know, the building phase and creating a new business and managing it and leading it is it really gets me going.
Okay, you started this in the fall. You've had the idea for a while. You talked to me about it last winter. So it's been in your head for a while. Driving force, then you also said, I want to rearrange our thinking. Rather than selling cattle, I'm selling beef. There's a big difference in that mindset. Tell me about it from your perspective.
Absolutely. You know, cattle feeders are trying to make a living selling cattle, and they should. And that has always been our mindset as well. But now we're trying to, at least a portion of the herd, approximately a fourth of it currently, we're trying to make money on those cattle selling meat. So we, you know, we pay attention to the breeding. You know, there's a Black Angus claim that we make, all natural claim, no hormones, no antibiotics. We're only finishing heifers because the heifers are worth less in town. So there's a little bit of a value added piece there.
Yeah. And there's another thing we talked about, heifer frame size. And I told the feed yard people, and I've worked for just about, you know, everybody, so including beef feeders. And I said, you know, you and the Packers keep wanting these animals to get so damn big. If you look at the old state fair photos from the 1950s, those little Herefords were, you know, like mm-hmm. My dog's about, you know, that big. And the thing is, you served somebody a steak, it did not cover the dinner table. And when you take these animals now to 1,500 pounds on the hoof, the steak is big enough to, you know, put in the trunk of your car. You're going with an animal that finishes at 1,250 pounds to 1,300 pounds, so your cut size is a little bit different. I have to think, as a consumer, this is going to start to be an issue. The meat business has notoriously done what's good for the meat packers, and also, yeah, there's a customer out there. I think that there's a reset on this, and you might be leading the charge. Am I right?
I believe so. We introduced corn into our ration much earlier so the cattle can finish at a lighter weight. You know, we still want them to get fat. We still want them to grade prime, but they're going to finish at a lighter weight. Instead of going out and running a 9-weight steer on grass or something like that and feeding it a grower ration, and then by the time it's finished, it does weigh that 1,500, 1,600 pounds, we're going to start these heifers on corn very early. They're going to finish at 1,250 to 1,300 pounds. We then want to cut our steaks 1.25 inches thick. If you, a 1,600 pound animal, you cut that steak 1.25 inches thick.
It's going to be, it's going to weigh a pound and a half. Gross.
Yes, which I would love to eat, but the average consumer
doesn't want a 48 ounce cut.
They want a 12 or 14 ounce steak, you know, and I feel that I was validated. Amber and I went to a restaurant there in central Iowa, and she ordered a 12 ounce prime rib. Yeah. And it came out, and it was only about, I don't even know if it was 3/4 inch thick. That's not appealing to the eye on the plate. It was the diameter of the steak was huge, so they had to cut it thin. That it probably came from a huge calf. And I just, the consumer, it's a better steak, a better eating experience when it's 1.25 inches thick.
And I don't want to, certainly I've worked for these companies. There's a piece of email here from Cargill. I'm not bashing big meat. I'm just saying that they have historically, notoriously, done what worked for them, and the consumer had to eat it. There's
right.
four companies that control 85% of the beef product. So they don't care if it works better for them to have a 1,500-pound carcass come in there or hoof weight come in there. But like I said, we're getting away from what the consumer actually probably wants.
Absolutely. And the vertical integration that we now have, the cattle are born there, raised all the way through there, and now the meat is sold in our store.
For you.
For me.
Yeah, you've become vertically integrated.
The vertical integration that I possess allows me to worry about the end product. You know, a lot of times, you know, there's many farmers in my area that all raise great cattle, but are they getting paid on the quality? Mm. I don't believe that they are, because it all gets commingled with everything else that goes to the packer.
Yeah.
We're getting paid for our quality now.
To sell on the rail, as it said, and I guess we should make sure that for the person that's listening to this that's not in the livestock business, that means you're getting paid on the quality components, you know, choice and marbling and all of those kinds of things. They talk about selling it on the grid. I'm sorry.
Right, they do, but you know, when...
But you've got to be a feed yard. If you're just a guy that's got 60 fats that go to market every year, you're probably not big enough to be able to sell your stuff on a grid.
No, and also when they move to selling it on the grid like that, instead of having to come out and bid on the live cattle, it kind of has destroyed the demand.
Yeah.
You know, they basically have a captive supply, and they're not going to tell you what it's worth
right.
until after it's hanging there.
Right.
Well, it's hard to take it back home.
You can't repossess half a beef.
I believe that has been a deception of the cattle producer, that they're going to get paid a premium. I think it destroys demand because they don't have to come out to the pen and bid on the cattle.
What about, okay, now you've been at this for a few months compared to the old days. In the old days, what'd you do? You fed out your stuff and then you took it to the sale barn.
In the old days, we'd feed we would sell an 8 or 9 weight calf.
Oh, you sold them as feeders.
We sold them as feeders. We did not finish a lot.
Yeah.
We had finished a few at different times, but we'd not finished
a lot. You finished a few for so you have beef in the freezer or your neighbor or whatever.
Right. Or, one of our brother-in-laws, Amber and my, our brother-in-law, we finished cattle at his place before and shipped them. And, we're just trying to find different ways to make money in the cattle industry because we know we want to stay in it, but the margins are quite thin. And the finishing the cattle wasn't great. For a while, we bought and backgrounded calves along with our own. The market swings there, the margin there was not great. We don't do that anymore. And this is something that I'm very passionate about, and this is our next venture.
When you start doing something that's a diversification, and I'm a self-employed guy for 29 years, so I always set the goal of how can I have a little bit of income diversification. You have this thing where you say, yeah, but why, Damien, you make the bulk of your revenue, let's say, doing speaking engagements? Why would you go and do this thing over here when it's not as profitable? Well, what about the rainy day? Or what about the thing like that? Right now, we're selling $7 corn and $14 to $15 soybeans. You're good at farming. You've set records. That's why you're a founder of Extreme Ag. Why not just concentrate on grain farming and not even fool with us?
Number one, I'd get bored, I guess, really. But I believe in diversification. And I always, about 10 years ago, I was involved in a business that was outside of agriculture and it didn't work out and I lost some money. So now every business that we take on, I always felt that there's a symmetry. It started organically from another business. And then I learned from you.
The term
intentional congruence. So the meat business is, look at the intentional congruence there. Obviously, we're feeding the cattle.
Yeah.
You're
feeding the stuff that you raise.
Yes.
So you can be in charge. You've got rough ground to have cow-calf on.
Yep.
So you got rough ground with fence and then you've got the feed stuff. And then also, the only thing you didn't have demand. So I want to talk about demand, but I want to talk about diversification. You also do get, diversification can also equal dilution. I've had that. I did direct-to-consumer beef. I didn't do it quite like you. I didn't have a retail store, and I wasn't selling it by individual cut. But eventually, Mrs. Mason said, you're gone for 6 days at a time. I'm out here taking care of steers. I'm not comfortable doing all that by myself. And then she says, more importantly, how much do we make? Well, not enough to justify it to still be in there. At some point, you have to have enough scale on any diversification venture. Otherwise, it's just dilution. Help give me your perspective for our listener, because diversification can't equal dilution.
It can. I have three sons. They all want to come into the operation. And there's other farm families that have brothers or siblings that work together. But one of the things that I think brings about problems is when everybody's trying to do the same job and they're stepping on each other's toes. I have Connor, Colin, and Kale.
Yeah.
Colin is a senior at Iowa State in animal science. He is passionate about the cattle. He's passionate about this meat business. And one of the reasons to do this was I believe we can be successful at it, and it creates a spot with him that he and his two brothers going forward aren't all trying to do the same job. Mm-hmm. They will be partners. At least I believe they will be partners. They will be partners, but they're not always trying to fill the same role of what field are we going to go plant here? What truck are we going to go work on here? Things like that. They can spread out and work together in a diversified business. And I want to create an operation that my three sons can work at and potentially some grandchildren along the way. And it can grow and expand as needed or as desired.
I want to talk more about diversification and some tips that you're going to share. But before I do that, dear listener, if you are into what's happening on forward-thinking, business-minded, frontline farming operations, you should be checking out what we're doing at Extreme Ag. Kelly is one of the founders of Extreme Ag. They brought me on a year and a half ago to produce the Cutting the Curve podcast. I've also been to many events and all the farmers' operations to record videos, trials that they are doing, new practices, new things that they're doing cutting edge, working with new equipment, varying different treatments, post-emergence sugar treatments and biologicals and all kinds of cool stuff. Anyway, go to extremeag.farm. That's no E on the front of it, just extremeag.farm. That's the website. They also are very prevalent on social media, at Facebook and Twitter. But I do encourage you to go there and check out the stuff we're doing at Extreme Ag. It's free. You can just go there and see a whole bunch of stuff. I've produced like 140 video podcasts, not to mention videos for them. So it's really good stuff. Go and check it out, extremeag.farm. All right. Diversification can equal dilution. How do you keep that from happening? How do you get to where you're, you know, jack of all trades, master of none? How do you get to where it's not just one more thing? You know, you see some operations and it could be farming. It could be a corporation. They've got a lot of stuff going on, but they're C pluses at all of them. They're not even Bs on any of them. We see that. How do you keep from being five different C pluses versus just one A?
I want to be five A's, and I believe it's delegation. I guess I would be the overall CEO, the overall leader, but in the trucking industry, the trucking portion, KSX Transportation,
yep.
I've got Mike and Jocelyn that run that. In the office, we've got Sabrina. Integrated Ag Solutions is Mike Evans and Mike Wingrove. On the farm, we have Richie mm-hmm. and Connor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the shop, you have Corey and Josh.
Yeah, so you've got good people
I've
in key places.
People, and I don't have to try to micromanage.
Uh-huh.
If I had to do it all, then it
you
would be diluted. There's not enough hours in the day.
Yeah, and also then you're just running from one thing to the next, and it's almost like you're patching and putting out fires versus actually running something.
Absolutely. You know, like your example, you chose not to do direct-to-the-consumer beef anymore because you were gone 60 days a year and Mrs. Mason didn't want to do the chores.
Yeah.
It became diluted because you couldn't do it all yourself.
Actually, about 120 days a year, but yeah, sometimes 6 days at a time. And she said, well, I got a problem. You know, who do I call? And what do we do there? And then more importantly, what?
Yes.
And if you're only doing 20 steers, what are you really earning? So it wasn't enough, which brings me to the next thing, scale. Certainly, Cargill's feed yards, their scale. I drive by Cactus Feeders, they're at scale, you know, like have a million animals on feed or something at any given time. What's the right scale for you? At some point, you run out of space or you run out of facility. In your processing or in your retail, what's the right number? What is scale enough to justify even fooling with it, but also what's too big?
We're currently processing 10 head a month.
Okay.
And
you've got a contractual arrangement to do that.
Yes.
You don't own a processing plant.
No.
And you wouldn't want to own a processing plant.
No. You know, we looked in the cost of building one just to know, but the labor piece, and because that's a skill set that just not everybody has.
Yeah, it's not like it's not like just come in here and take fry, you know, burger and fry orders at McDonald's. You actually have to, it's hard work. And you have USDA inspected mm-hmm. and all this kind of stuff. So there's the labor. Because I keep hearing about, remember the government was going to pass this thing where they were going to throw a bunch of money here for small meat processors. Could you have gotten in on that?
Yeah, I believe we could have. To build the processing facility that we looked at, it was going to be like $1.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple potential partners. We were interested. We wanted to really look at it, but it just really came down to the labor.
So what do you think when you look at this, what's been the one surprise? You opened your doors at Labor Day. You had the idea before that. What's been the thing that you're like, son of a bitch, I didn't see this coming?
Some of the lesser known cuts of steak that we still choose to bring, because otherwise they would go to hamburger. Mm-hmm. The real challenge is selling all the hamburger. It's the education piece, telling people, you know, what this steak is, what this cut does. Right now, I would say we have, you know, it's easy to sell a ribeye,
yeah,
but you got to be able to sell the skirt steaks and things like
uh-huh.
that.
Uh-huh.
There's some other, you know, we just always assume that we would cut chuck roast. When I'm with the processor.
Cut, meaning eliminate or cut stuff into chuck roast?
We would cut things into chuck roast.
Yeah.
That'd be one of the cuts we had. The processor, Lou, he said, why do you want all the chuck roast? I didn't even know there was another option.
I don't either.
He said, you can cut a chuck eye steak, a Terrace Major, a Denver steak, and a flank steak. I didn't know what, or not a, pardon me, not a flank, a flat iron.
Okay. It all comes from the chuck?
It all comes from the chuck. It's just they're going to cut it in a different way. I knew a chuck was worth $7 or $8 a pound.
Yeah.
These other steaks are going to be worth at least $15. It's been a great deal. It's added value to the calf.
I'm going to take this moment to disagree. Chuck roast is my favorite roast. It's got fat. It always stays moist. It's got tons of flavor. I'm a chuck roast guy, so it kind of bothers me that you bastardized my chuck roast, but that's okay. All right, so let's talk about, to the person listening to this, is like, hey, you know what? This is cool. And Damien, you're always talking about business stuff. I'm out here. It doesn't matter what you're doing. Maybe you are driving down the road right now in Nebraska and you're a seed salesperson, or maybe you're a cranberry producer in Wisconsin and you're listening to this, whatever. But the thing that surprised you was that you're getting is diverse. Your surprise was how you could take your education that you could upsell or create some new cuts. That's one of the educations. Yep. What's about an education that you're like, you learned the hard way? Remember the thing like, oh man, this kind of cost me money or held me up, anything like that?
The building, of course, cost more than I thought it was going to.
Mm-hmm. As a retail outlet.
As a retail outlet.
Walk-in coolers, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. The freezer is 20 by 30.
Yeah.
Supply chain issues, waiting on stuff. It took forever for the floor to come in, the flooring in the retail area.
Okay.
You know, all that. And then, of course, it's over budget. Mm-hmm. But you're at some point, you're just purchasing what is available because of the supply chain issue. And the budget just kind of goes out the window because you just got to get completed.
One thing that I think is interesting, and you're probably this way also, I haven't had a real job for 29 years. And I've had other ventures besides just the speaking business. I've had a lot of different little things I do, ventures, whatever. And then there's people that have normal jobs and they've always got this idea they're going to start a business. They're going to try a new venture. But there's always something. Timing's not right. Not in this economy. Interest rates too high. Do you think about any of that? Because I got to be honest with you. I mean, I don't. I think I know I can do this and here's how I'm going to do it. And I'm also willing to learn with the mistakes. I find that most people that keep acting like there's some external reason are just looking for an external reason, excuse.
Right. Things are never going to be
perfect.
Yeah. And you can't. And they always want to know, well, what the plan and things like that. Well, I have this general plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that we can finance it. We want to start small, let it build organically. But there is no reason to make this solid plan because there's going to be those surprises along the way. It's going to grow and evolve, and you just have to have faith that you can figure it out.
By the way, we didn't really get a complete answer. You're processing 10 animals per month, so 120 animals per year. What do you think you're capable of selling? Do you think you could double that by a year from now?
I think that our facility is big enough to double that, but we've got to be able to find enough processing space. Our current processor, I don't know that they can handle more than 10 a month right now because of their other business. There is another processor in Northeast Iowa that we are scheduled to take. Starting in February, we're scheduled to take 6 a month there as well.
Okay, so you think you can do 16 a month?
We can do 16 a month right now but we got to prove that we can sell it all.
Seasonality, there's some people that these calves are born in April and then sometimes they fall calf and all that. You have any ups or downs on your supply?
We're managing that pretty well right now. Our cow herd, and this was just luck, our cow herd evolved from being normal where we calved everything basically February, March, April. We wanted most of it in February and March. And then we sold those because we tore up a lot of pasture and put to corn. Then when we bought some cows back, we were buying first calf heifer pairs.
Mm-hmm.
And sell them as bred seconds. Then we started to buy cows in May and June because we recognized the fact, this is my dad, we recognized the fact that on May 1st, every cattle producer, every farmer says, I'm done calving.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reason he's done calving is he's tired of it.
Yeah, right.
And on May 1st, he sells everything that hasn't calved. So then you're going and buying cows at a salvage value instead of a replacement value.
A cow with a calf in the uterus.
Yes, you're buying bred cows at a salvage value instead of at a replacement value.
I never understood. I mean, I was from a dairy farm, so we had calves were born every day or, a couple a week or whatever. So it's we didn't have that whole thing where beef people want to have their calves all in a 4-week time frame or 6-week time frame or whatever, 2 heat cycles. I never understood that. So yeah, you've got calves coming all the time. It's a little bit more work, but you gotta be out there anyhow.
It's a little bit more work, but now when we're calving on the grass in June, July, August, rather than in the snow and the mud in February and March, that the work It's traded. It's you're calving all the time. However, it's not that intense work in the wintertime trying to do all that. In a lot of ways, it's easier. So I don't know that it has created more work to spread it out, but our spread out calving window allows us to always have cattle on feed.
The person that's listening to this right now says, all right, they have questions. I'm trying to think of what those questions would be. Did any part of this scare you? I mean, you've done other entrepreneurial ventures, you got other businesses, but there's a person that says, I've never started anything, or I'm thinking about adding to my farm thing. What's your thought?
I was scared nobody would come.
Yeah.
I was scared that we couldn't sell anything because all the other businesses I've started, I'm a bit of a control freak. The other businesses we've started, we have, we're not really dependent. You know, plant food, we want to be able to sell it, but there's a demand for it because of fertilizer, and there really isn't other competition for it. But with this, with the beef, obviously people can go to the grocery store. There's other direct to consumers. I was scared that nobody would come because I don't have control over that. I worry about the things I can't control sometimes.
Farm people are very good at producing stuff, and you heard me say this. They sell stuff. They sell truckloads of soybeans or pounds of milk or what have you. But they generally struggle, in my observation, with being sales people. You are now selling to a consumer. You have to be a marketer. And I'm not talking about marketing on the Chicago Board of Trade. I'm talking about promotion. I'm talking about telling the consumer why they are. It's not as hard for you as it is for some. What's your advice to people that are farmers that still don't have the sales gene?
A positive attitude and hire somebody that does. Mm-hmm. I've been so impressed with Amber. Amber has slowed down. She's an RN. She slowed down at the hospital, you know, to help with this store. And her promotional ideas never cease to amaze me. She came up with the idea when, you know, the hamburger was starting to collect because that's the biggest product.
The hardest thing to sell premium.
Yes.
You can sell premium ribeyes all day long. Selling a premium on a hamburger, a lot of times people don't go for that, although I do because I think there's good burger and there's school lunch burger.
Hamburger is 55% about what you're going to get. Yeah. So we're talking a lot of hamburger.
Yeah, half of your product.
And Amber came up with the idea of 25 pounds of hamburger for $100. You know, our hamburger is priced at $5 a pound.
Yeah.
25 pounds of hamburger for $100, and holy cow, did she sell a lot of hamburger.
Yeah.
You know, it's simple things like that that really took off.
But you're losing some margin right there. Now, here's another thing. As much as I love farm people, I said that a lot of times they don't have the sales gene. Marketing promotion is not their friend. And what they've always done is also possess a commodity mindset. And they say, well, I can do that and I can do it cheaper. what if you do it? I remember hearing the guys at my first farm 20 years ago giving hell to the pumpkin patch down the road. Yeah, they're down there selling that bale of straw for $5. You know, you can get it for two. I said, well, they probably sell 8 bales of straw. So you want to whore out for 8 bales and $3 of difference? $24. And so their mindset is always how to be cheap and cheap and cheap. And what you're talking about here is a premium product. It's a change in mindset. Do you think that some farm people just really struggle with the idea that they should sell stuff at a premium?
We do. Farmers do. Farmers, you know, what did Paul Harvey say? That's the only one that produces, they buy retail and sell wholesale. And I think that's eternally the mindset.
I think it was John Kennedy that said that. But here's the thing. You know what? If you don't ever know who to attribute a quote to, go with Yogi Berra, because half the clever stuff that's ever been said, they try and tell you was Yogi, a catcher for the 1950s New York Yankees.
Right, I misquoted
that. All right. So anyway, Yogi Berra. Yeah. Who said that? I'm sure it was Yogi Berra. Okay. Or Abe Lincoln. Okay. So selling stuff at a premium. Have you met resistance that you didn't think you would have, or has it been more less resistance than you thought?
Less resistance. It's been very positive.
Shipping stuff. It's a new concept.
That's a headache.
Employees right now, and it seems like everywhere you're struggling with employees. You've tried to keep it lean. To expand, you're going to need people. Do you envision that being a problem?
It has not. That's been, you know, the shipping has been something that is a little bigger headache than what we anticipated. The employee part, though, there has been different people, you know, local people that are interested in a part-time job, and that's been very refreshing.
Well, there's a couple things that I think there's a confluence, if you will. First off, there's people like you that say, hey, why am I letting all the margin be made by a packer? And I'm not anyway bashing these packers. They're businesses. They're there to maximize money. But I see more of this happening now. And I think there's a confluence of a lot of stuff that's going to make this more able to attain success doing something direct to consumer. The consumer got locked down and was buying stuff on the internet left and right. The Amazon effect. And then there's the fact that the foodie crowd now is looking for an experience that they don't just go to their Publix grocery store and get. This looks like it's the perfect time to do what you're doing.
I agree. COVID changed the world. Amazon changed the world. And people also want to know where their food comes from. All those things are converging, and this makes it the right time to try.
I think that that's the right thing. So what about when it becomes saturated? What about when there's one of you on every corner? Is that going to happen, first off? I don't think that it will because
I don't think that it will.
There's people that don't want to do the work.
Right.
What if it does happen? Then does it just become – does what you're doing become commoditized?
No. I just really don't think that there's going to be –
Because you'll just keep working to uncommoditize it.
Well, there's so much, there's demand for food. Obviously, everybody's going to eat.
Yeah.
And that many people just aren't going to try what we're trying here.
I'd agree with that. I got a postcard right here that came in a package. You did a thing where you sent it to me as an experiment. And tell me what a package looks like, just because people are probably wondering what makes this special. So it comes, it's vac-packed. Everything's vac-packed. It's in dry ice. It's got a card like this.
Yes, like every steak is individually cryo-packed. The steaks will stay, the meat will stay good, thawed out in your refrigerator for 60 days.
Because of the way it's packaged.
Because of the way it's packaged.
And if I went and did that from the grocery store, it'd be in freezer paper and it would never last that long.
Exactly.
What do you think then the advice is? There's no such thing as the right time. Just go ahead and do this. Start at a level you can live with. What other thing do you think the person needs to hear that's like, because you and I both believe that sort of vertical integration is what the big companies always did, and now we're seeing it at your level, but also direct to consumer has wheels. Yours is a little harder, but what's your thought on this, that the person that's out there that's thinking about doing this, what's the reason that they are not, and what would you tell them?
I think everybody always wants to have everything planned out in a very microscopic manner, and they think that they're going to control all this, and you just got to take a shot. You can't, because it's going to, the outpouring of support from the local community has been more than what we thought. Yeah. The people wanting a job has been more than what we thought. The shipping, which I thought would be simpler, is a little bit more expensive, a little bit harder. You can't forecast all that. So quit trying.
And I talked about in my business book that business plans are great for borrowing money because bankers want to see business plans, but they're good for borrowing money. They're not good for making money. You didn't have a detailed 5-year business plan when you did this, but you're pretty convinced that you could do this. Bringing the kids back in, that's good. Now, there's a lot of people that say, oh, well, are you doing this just to give your kids something to do? If they weren't coming back, would you still do this?
I would still try to do this, yes, but I would have to find an employee to run it.
Right. Well, you might anyhow.
Right. But no, I'm not just doing this to give Colin something to do. I think that we will somewhere between double and quadruple the amount per calf that we'll make.
Yeah. So you're making more money per animal, and that's the big thing. And then also it's just there's a lot of reasons this all works. And there's some reasons for some people it won't work. And I guess that that's why it probably won't end up taking off. But I think that there's room for this. Do you think that we'll look back someday and say, man, there's this golden era where this started becoming the thing, where direct-to-consumer popcorn, direct-to-consumer whatever from the farm level, you and I get invited every year to the Farmer's Share breakfast. And I always have to hear these ag people say this. Well, you know, the farmer only makes 14 cents out of every... Well, you know what? I'm not being mean to the farmers, but the reason for that is there's a lot of value added after it leaves the farm.
Absolutely.
And you are doing that value added. So the point is this: that you can bitch and go to the Farmer's Share breakfast and talk about how every dollar of food that's spent in the United States, only 14 cents goes to the farmer. Well, or you can realize that's because there's a bunch of value added processing in between the consumer and the food at the farm. You're recapturing that.
Absolutely. And this is the only way to recapture it. I can't recapture this by selling the cattle to a packer.
Yeah, you go to Cargill and say, you know what? I just went to the Farmer's Share breakfast and I only get 14 cents right out of all the food dollars that are spent. So you know what? Give me more money. And they'll say, okay, get out of our office. I mean,
yeah, that's right. Exactly. And, you know, I've heard those stats before. I think it's just it's a shock and awe tactic to get people wound up.
Yeah, and it does. I mean, from the Farm Bureau meetings to the whatever ag thing, and it does get people wound up because then they think they've been taken.
Right.
But, you know, and once that milk leaves the farm, it's got to get pasteurized and packaged and hauled around and put a label on it and then go to some store. And, you know, grocers aren't making big margins.
No, and I own a trucking company, and it's okay, but it's not going to, you're not getting rich at it.
Yeah, so everybody,
the guy hauling the milk isn't getting rich either.
No, so everywhere in between, there's a little bit of margin, but it's not like all, it's not all that extra 86 cents doesn't go to one place.
No, it does not.
It goes a lot of different places. You're now getting it in a couple of different places.
Right. Well, you know, we're now keeping that 86 cents gross, but it certainly isn't all net.
Exactly, because you're still having expense. You've got refrigeration now that you didn't used to have, and you've got taxes on a facility, and you've got all those things, in manpower in particular. What else? Last thing. Take us out of here. Garrett Land and Cattle, income diversification from the farm level on, reclaiming margin. I think that's what I'll call this podcast. Reclaiming margin through diversification of operation.
You need to have a high-quality product. You need to have a great product.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the point is in that farmer mentality, I'll just be cheaper. Then you'll never win by being cheaper when your competition is Walmart.
Don't try to be cheaper and try to be better. Yeah. And better takes that financial piece out of the equation just a little bit. Obviously, we're still doing it to make money, but try to be better. And don't always try to be cheaper because you're in a niche market.
Yeah. And the reality is, if you even use Walmart as an example, you go through the grocery part of Walmart, they're not all about being the cheapest. They're bringing in organic vegetables now, and they're doing a premium. They have versions, but they have a premium package of beef also. So we got to realize that there's consumers that will pay, and even in this increased inflationary environment, there's consumers that will pay a premium for a better product.
Absolutely. There is. Walmart is obviously recognizing that. Almost every brand that you go to, or every restaurant that you go to, there's always a higher quality choice.
Last thing about the marketing, you talk about your story, and people go to ag meetings all the time and say, you just got to go out there and tell your story. And I'm like, I'm not sure people care that much about your story. But if you're buying direct from the farmer, they do like the story. What's your reaction been? You say, hey, we're a fifth generation farm in Iowa. I can, if you want to come out here, I'll even show you these animals on the hoof. I mean, it's about transparency and story and all that.
You know, the website, the Facebook videos that go out, we try to show pictures of the cows, you know, in the sustainable era that we're in now for farming, right. And me being the carbon guy, you know, the cows out on the cover crops and that circularity and the sustainability of our farm, people really find value, and that makes it's a feel-good story that people buy into.
Yeah, you're using cover crops, which is good for the ground. You're also grazing the cover crops, et cetera, et cetera. So the story has resonated, you think, with your customers.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. His name's Kelly Garrett. My name's Damian Mason. You knew that. And I got to tell you, if you want to learn more about what's happening there, go to Garrett Land and Cattle. What is it? Where do I find this?
GLCbeef.com.
GLCbeef.com. And if you have a topic you'd like me to cover here on the Business of Agriculture, please send me your request. I like talking about various things. You know, we got everything from climatological issues to direct-to-consumer agriculture. And I do see this catching on more. I very much appreciate you being here. Share these episodes with somebody you think can benefit from it. We are now getting tons and tons of listeners. And I also want to encourage you, if you like what you're seeing here, go to extremeag.farm. Extremeag.farm. Tons and tons of videos and podcasts there that will tell you what's happening on some of the forward-thinking farming operations in the United States of America and Canada, places like Garrett Land and Cattle. Till next time, it's the Business of Agriculture. Hey, thanks for being here. This episode of the Business of Agriculture was brought to you by Pattern Ag. You've heard me talk about Pattern Ag because I think it's a pretty cool concept. New technology that allows you to predict the problems you're going to have and therefore treat them before those problems cost you money. What kind of problems am I talking about? Pests and disease. Things like corn rootworm, sudden death syndrome, cyst nematode, and a whole bunch of other bad things that happen out there in the field that can cost you money. Guess what? Pattern Ag will let you find out ahead of time if the disease or the pest pressure is there, and therefore you're treating it before it costs you any money. What a great concept. Go to pattern.ag, that's www.pattern.ag, to learn more about their product, their technology, how it can make you money, save you yield, and also where you can find a rep that can come out there and do the work for you. Pattern.ag.